Welcome to the second episode of the Hope Illuminated podcast, your source for the stories, science, and strategy of suicide prevention and mental health promotion, where we live, learn, and work. I'm your host, Dr. Sally Switzer-Thomas, and I'm on a life mission to empower communities with solutions that help people overcome isolation and despair and rekindle a passion for living. Each episode, we're joined by international experts who inspire hope and offer real guidance. Welcome to the show. I am so grateful you're here. Today, we are talking about suicide prevention in the workplace and best practices in training and changing culture within industry. And this topic became near and dear to my heart after I lost my brother Carson to suicide in 2004. And I realized there was this huge gap in between who was dying by suicide and where our efforts were focused. Now, understandably, we are focused primarily on youth suicide prevention, I think internationally, certainly in the United States. We don't want our kids to die of anything. But when we have a very different demographic who's at very high risk, we need to have different strategies. And so it made sense to us that if we're reaching kids in schools, we're going to reach adults in the workplace. So over the last 12 years or so, I've done some thinking and learning from experts like LaHue about today and testing strategies out, and have come to a couple of conclusions that I think you'll hear bear out in our case study today with Mason Construction. Number one, I really believe throughout all of suicide prevention, not just workplace suicide prevention, that we need to move from awareness into action. It's not good enough that we just change people's knowledge and kind of shift their head about things. We have to move their hearts and we have to move their feet. And we have to get people involved at a very personal level. And in order to do that, the best way is to really get buy-in from within the workplace culture. So one of the most important things that I do when I'm working with an industry or with a workplace is I spend a lot of time listening and building relationships within that system. So we do things like focus groups and in-depth interviews, and we collect the data that they have around mental health utilization and stress and absenteeism and presenteeism and leadership opinion and all of these things. And we really spend a lot of time in that space. And that does a lot of things for us, because I know suicide prevention, but I don't necessarily know construction or oil and gas or finance or any of these other industries that we work in. So it helps me understand cultural nuances and language and where the strengths of an industry or a company are and where their vulnerabilities are. I also discover through that process who are the champions within this workplace, who are the people that can pull this message into the culture and inside of all of the very specific, you know, infrastructure and culturally barriered off things that would be really hard for an outsider to penetrate. It also gives me some benchmark information that we can measure against for change over time. And when I do this work and really start to develop these relationships and take the time to really listen, what happens is magical, because the people that I'm developing these relationships with feel like they start to own this process, and it becomes by them, about them, and for them. And what you're going to hear today in this example from Australia is this turns into pride. People become very proud of the fact that they are making a difference in their own life and in other people's lives, in their company's lives, and in their industry lives. And that matters greatly. You can't instill that as an outsider. That has to grow organically within the workspace. And I can't think of a better example than Mason Construction. The other thing that I've really learned is that this works best, this whole approach of mental health promotion and suicide prevention works best peer-to-peer within industry. Yes, professionals have their role, and it's a very important role, and there are definitely things that peers can't and shouldn't be handling. But in top cultures like construction, first responder, lawyers, and so forth, it really needs to start peer-to-peer. There's a lot of reasons that I'm sure Jorgen will get into on why this matters. There's this reciprocity piece that I'm willing to ask for help if I get to pay it back later. There's a trust level that you understand a little bit more about what I've gone through because you go through something similar. And it really is magic when we get those peers to reach out and take action. The other thing we're going to learn about today is why construction there are a number of reasons why this makes sense. It's a very large industry internationally, and if we can make a difference in saving lives in this industry, we can literally lower the world's suicide prevention rate because there's that many people. There's also some specific risk factors. Number one, that it's a male-dominated industry, but there's also some other pieces that we'll hear from Jurgen today about why this might be so. But there's also a piece of readiness. It's making suicide prevention a part of health and safety culture is where it's best situated. And no industry has gravitated to that more quickly than construction because they have such a strong safety culture and because they already have a mantra and a mindset that, you know, no accidents, no incidents, so zero suicide totally fits in. So with that, let me introduce my friend and colleague from Down Under, Jurgen Gulstrup. He's calling in tonight from Brisbane, Australia. And in my research and prepping for his introduction, I went to his LinkedIn page and got a chuckle because it says, hey, I'm a plumber and a suicidologist, which is absolutely spot on and quite a combination of expertise. He's currently the founder and CEO of Mason Construction, which is a charity organization that is really changing how we think about suicide prevention in industry. Mace was established in 2008 after some research showed that there's such a high level of suicide in the construction workers. And that research showed that construction workers are really six times more likely to die from suicide than an accident at work. And if you think about how much we invest in accident safety in construction or line of duty deaths in first responder work versus how much we invest in psychological safety, you can't compare the two. So this was certainly a paradigm shift to look at this research and discover we are missing the mark if we're truly invested in protecting harm, you know, preventing harm and saving lives. The research also bore out that young workers in particular are a focus of concern. They were over two times more likely to take their lives than other Australian men. So lower level trades, younger workers, people coming in as apprentices, these were a really important target demographics for me. For workers in the construction industry, suicide just seems part of the reality. And I've had this experience too, Jurgen. It just seems that everybody I work with has known a coworker who's died of suicide. And there's just all this pent up grief, especially in communities that don't have a program like Mason Construction. Nobody's ever talked about this or acknowledged it, or let alone addressed anything around prevention. It just feels like this is inevitable. This is just going to happen here. And we know now that that's not necessarily the case. There are things we can do to prevent this tragedy from happening. The work in the industry is highly transient. So employees are bouncing back from different work sites, and it's really hard to develop a community and to get access to resources. And so that makes it for a challenge that Mace has figured out a workaround, and you're going to hear about that. The other work for research shows that the workers really did find it difficult to express feelings because of the nature of the work. It made it hard to reach out, that they had some pride around saying that they had a problem that was really difficult, that wasn't seen as manly. And again, this is something very consistent throughout any kind of man-dominated work culture. There's this barrier of what it means to kind of acknowledge vulnerability and to reach out for support. The other interesting finding that the research showed was that there was a strongly held belief that suicide was just impulsive, that there wasn't anything that people could do. They wouldn't show any signs. They would just do it. And so it was kind of inevitable and people felt helpless. And Mace has really challenged that. So the recommendations from all this research led to this campaign, Mace in Construction, that was really about raising awareness about mental health and well-being, combining it with really effective training that empowered the workers to reach out to one another and effectively have conversations that had concern and linked them to appropriate care. And it's just been amazing to see how far Mace has come. Fast forward to today, 112,986, oh my gosh, people have been trained through this program since 2008 to be better equipped for suicide awareness and intervention. And that has led to 5,474 individual people being impacted. They call it individual cases managed. So I'm interested to learn what all that means. So to sum up, Mason Construction is about four things. Number one, it's about raising awareness. And Durga's going to tell about the different types of communication strategies that are evolving, shifting attitudes, beliefs, and actions. Number two, about building capacity that makes those through very specific training programs that have strong evidence base that builds confidence and competence that people can do the work needed to save lives and to improve lives. Number three, they take it beyond just raising awareness and connecting people. They want to make sure that each person that has been identified at risk is managed in a way that they're getting the right care and that it's working. So they provide this kind of health support that is really effective. And then number four, which is so important and so few nonprofit organizations make this a top priority, it's research. They are leading the research in return on investment for their work, on gathering data on where they need to work and what's most useful. And so it thrills me to pieces to introduce my friend. We originally met in 2013 at the International Association of Suicide Prevention's World Congress in Oslo. I was presenting there on kind of support in the workplace, and I saw his session on the agenda on this construction suicide prevention thing, and I made a beeline, and I was just like, oh my gosh, Durga, you are doing everything that we hope to do, and we just aren't there yet. And so immediately I knew I had a mentor and an inspiration. And then I was so honored in 2014 to be asked to come to Brisbane to present at their mental health conference. And again, learned so much from the well over 250 industry and mental health leaders that were attending there. So welcome, Jorgen. So glad you're here. Thank you so much. And let's get into the show.
Thank you, Sandy. Always good to chat to you.
Yes, absolutely. So if you would start, please share with me a little bit of the backstory. I'm always interested, especially with founders of organizations that are so inspirational as yours is, what is the life path that led you here?
That's a good one. I just want to say that when people listen to me, what they're hearing is not a unique Australian dialect. I wasn't actually born in Australia. I was born in Denmark. And through my school, all I wanted to do was to be a construction worker. I hated school, and all I wanted to do was be a plumber. My parents said, you can't leave school unless you find an apprenticeship. You're either earning or learning. So I went out and I walked the street and I finally found somebody who wanted to take me on as a plumbing apprentice. And I started as a plumber when I was 15. And my life was made. I had ended up in exactly the career where I wanted to go. I got to create things and build things. I got to work with people I liked. Things were fantastic. Up until I was about 17, and it was a bit like sort of a blanket that laid on top of me. And I lost all pleasure and enjoyment and became quite depressed and suicidal, particularly during winter, but in long periods, had suicide attempt and different periods with various kinds of medication and all those kind of things to go through it. And to be honest, I can't really remember much from between my 17th and 23rd year because it was just like a sort of a gray haze. But full forward at the end of it, I came to the conclusion that if something had to change, then something had to change. And I had eventually become the ill person rather than, you know, I had become my illness sort of almost. And everybody saw me as a depressed person rather than the person I was behind it. And I decided that I needed to have a change.
Was there a turning point or a moment where you felt that inspiration? Was there a mentor, or can you set the scene for us of when that happened for you?
What happened to me was, it was, well, I know exactly when I decided to move to Australia. It was minus 15 degrees and I was right lying on a roof trying to get this lead into these tires. And I came to the conclusion simply that the only way things was going to get better if I tried to put myself into a new environment and try it again sort of thing and got to reinvent myself. So I was married at the time. We moved to Australia. We had a child as soon as we arrived, and ever since, I have to admit that, you know, I've been really well. I haven't had a depressive episode since then.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, I did what I think that we migrants do the best, and I pointed out anything in Australia that wasn't like Denmark, and explained to them why they should change. So the natural progression from there was really to become a union official. And I became a union official for 13 years and got to lead one of the trade unions for about 6 or 7 years as well. And during that period, I lost several members to suicide. And it almost just became like an accepted part of life in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
So it was... We would talk about it, but to me it was really, when I was organizing, I was driving down to do my patch, and I got a call from one of the members on site who told me that one of the guys on site had died. He was only about my age at the time, but he told me that he had died by suicide. And I did what I thought was my job, and that was to go out, and we took a collection up on the job, and I found there was some pension money, and there was different money in different sources. So I found everything I could to support the family, and I then went to see his widow.
Mm.
And the things that I thought I had done all right, but she wasn't actually really interested. Like, for her, the questions were more about who's going to be the father for our three daughters. Can we stay in this house? And can they go to the schools they went? And she said, you know, it's funny. You actually spend more time at work than you spend at home. Did mm-hmm. anyone notice anything? And it dawned on me two things. One thing was, this could just as well have been my family. It was
right.
just a luck of the draw. And the other bit was, that we have to do something better than taking a collection up after the fact. So we actually
right.
have to be more proactive. So together with other people within the industry, and particularly within the union movement, we started to talk about maybe we should have an industry social worker. We had introduced counseling for construction workers some years before, but the uptake of it was very, very low. And we tried different things because we all noticed these suicide rates. At one stage, I looked at, we had a redundancy fund that had about 9 or 10,000 members, and I was preparing for a court case where there was a commission, Royal Commission, and I was preparing for that, and I was looking at what was my contribution going to be. And I looked at our board papers, and I identified 17 construction workers that had died by suicide within the 3 months prior to that court hearing. So it's just not right. We have to do something about it. And so that became the impetus where when we started talking about this, the industry then said we have to start from an evidence base. So instead
right.
of rushing out and doing something half-cocked, we said let's start by actually finding out what our problem is. So we partnered up with Griffith University, ASRAP as they're called, Australian Institute for Suicide Research and Prevention, to do what at the time was the biggest occupational study that had been done in Australia. And they looked at about 157,000 workers over a 7 year period, or the members of the various funds, to find out whether we had a problem. And we came back with a report saying that we had a big problem and something had to be done about it. So this was sort of the genesis of where we're coming from as an industry, was we realized there was a problem. And what is unique about the construction industry to some extent is long history of resolving big issues collectively. So we have we have pension funds that are collective pension funds. We have redundancy trusts. So we have a long history of actually doing big things collectively. So therefore, when we had that report, it wasn't a big step to say we're actually going to address suicide within the industry collectively as well.
That's the brilliant thing about starting with this industry is you're exactly right. Tackling big problems, not seen as overwhelming. Can-do attitude, incredibly efficient, methodical. So it's not a surprise that you started with the research and this not on my watch, zeitgeist. and watch out for my brother thing. It's so inspiring. Keep going.
Oh, so it is all of those things. Like the industry can be tough. You know, industrial relations is played pretty hard between the unions and the employers, and they certainly don't get on a lot of things. But on this one, they just decided that this one was one of the ones where we put politics aside.
Yep.
So we started by saying, sorry?
I said, yes, absolutely. It's one of those things that it's not divisive. There's no arguing about whether or not, you know, it's good. It's a good thing to prevent suicide.
We can use things to play politically every so often, but we also have to be big enough to realize when things are can't be done that way. And so at that stage, I decided it was time for a midlife crisis. So I sort of tossed my job in with the union and was going to go backpacking through Asia and find myself. And at the same time, the industry sat with that report and said someone had to do something. And then came to that conclusion that someone was probably us. And can you put something together? Just find something and implement it. Go out on site and just make it happen so we can prevent the suicide. But of course, when we started looking at it, there was none. There was some good building blocks, but there was really nothing that fitted the industry completely. And so the starting point was we then got an industry forum together. So we had about 70 or 80 key people from the Queensland industry together, unions and employers. And I had a bit of a concept that I took to them and to get their feedback. And it was interesting that at the time, the biggest rage were mentors. It was about you had to have mentors for just about anything. So my concept was, why don't we go and train these key people on site as mentors, and they can then be the connection point and support, and they might be able to do ongoing training and so on for other people. So I took that to the industry, and from both the unions and the employers, I got a resounding no, so that's not going to work. For the unions side, they said, those mentors, they are just going to be bosses' stooges. They're just going to be people appointed by the employers. Mm. Workers won't trust them. It's not going to work. And from the employer side, just emphatically, I heard, when we look at those mentors, they look like a union delegate. They smell like a union delegate. They probably are a union delegate. And we're not really part of that either. Mm. So we then thought, what can we do then? And it then came almost like reverse engineering. Somebody came up with that. We need a mick on the job, and I don't know why it was a mick, but it was just a mick that we all know somebody. We're going to have a cartoon with this guy, and he's the sort of the guy we can go to. And then somebody said, mick can actually be mates in construction, so it could actually be about mateship. And then somebody else said, well, mates in construction can actually be men actively talking to each other on sides. So it sort of became, we started from the end. But once we actually had those ideas, then the program became quite clear. We didn't want to create anything new. We thought that let's play to the strengths rather than the weakness. Mm-hmm. We thought it might be difficult enough to talk about mental health on site. So if we were to come with something completely new, that would be, a bridge too far, so to speak. So we then replicated the safety structure. We already had a safety structure in the industry. It was already bipartisan in terms of the acceptance of it. So why wouldn't we just replicate that from mental health safety structure as well? And then we worked backward from there. The way we did it was we know that you're not allowed on the construction site until you have done a safety induction, knowing where the toilets are, knowing where the crane lifts are, and all those kind of bits and pieces, because construction sites are dangerous workplaces. Mm-hmm. So why wouldn't we just have a mental health induction on every site as well? And so we generated what we call the general awareness training for that purpose. And at that time, we worked very closely with an organization called AusHelp in Australia. So we actually originally started off as AusHelp Queensland, being part of that and part of creating a national movement. We then worked out at some stage we probably had a slight difference in terms of approach, and we thought it'd probably be better if there's two options rather than just the one. So we then separated at a later stage. The concept of the general awareness training was firstly, one of the things when we started researching the project, and I went to speak to a number of subject matter experts, and it was actually quite disheartening because we came to them with this idea, and most of them say, yeah, that looks really good, that's really exciting and all that, but it won't work because men don't seek help.
Mm.
And that was, and then at some stage we sat down over a cup of coffee and discussed it, and then the sort of the penny just dropped. If we don't seek help, why do you keep asking us to do it?
Mm-hmm.
We're not actually very good at it. So why do you play into our weakness?
Mm-hmm.
My daughter come home with a report card, there's 3 A's and a C on it. If I focus on the C, the A's will eventually become B's. If I focus on the A's, the C will eventually mm-hmm. become a B. So if we keep playing to our weakness, we're actually never going to be good at it. So that then made us think about what are we actually really good at? And then we thought, as men in particular, you have some duties around help offering. You know, you stand up for your mate. You look out for each other. It's all right to accept help. We just don't ask for it.
Mm-hmm.
That's almost inherent in the industry. So we then said, actually, the general awareness training is not about help seeking. We're not about targeting the person who is struggling at all. Actually, even if the person struggling is not part of it, that's not really the big deal. We need everybody around that person. If everybody around that person has the duty to offer help, we just need one of them to do it, and we can actually make a difference. So
fabulous.
We did that firstly. So we're actually going to focus on the people who are doing well to do the heavy lifting and support the people rather than ask the people who are struggling the most to do the thing we find is the most difficult, asking for help. So once we did that, the rest of it became, then we have to find, we then request people to volunteer. So rather than the traditional way when you go in through an organization, they would say, top management need to be on board. We then get our supervisors on board and train them appropriately, and they can then look after the workers within their workforce. That works for some things, but it doesn't work, for instance, if the supervisor is a problem, or if the work conditions are the problem, or if there's some other issues that are the issues. So we then worked out, actually, we have to have a structure outside the workplace. So we ask people to volunteer with Mating Construction. So people don't do this in their capacity as an employee of the business, but they do that as a volunteer with a charity, Mating Construction. So when we do the general awareness training, we ask people to volunteer, and we get somewhere between 20 and 30% of the people who do the general awareness training volunteering as what we call connectors. We then go back to the employer and we offer to run connector training in the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
And we use Living Works for that. So they have a course called Safe Talk, and we contextualize that into the industry so it becomes relevant. And then they get a green ticket. So now we're... Sorry?
Oh, I was just saying, I'll add the Safe Talk training in the show notes for people who are interested.
That would be great. That would be great.
Yeah.
So what happens when we do the general awareness training, we get a white sticker. When you are a connector, you get a green sticker. When you get the white mm-hmm. sticker training, all you have to do is find the guy with the green sticker, and they will know what to do. The benefit of this model is that it moves itself because people go from site to site and from employer to employer. So it's actually the people who take the program with them across the industry as opposed to the businesses they work for.
Mm-hmm.
The businesses obviously allow for it because they invite us in and they allow us to do the training and so on. But the work is actually done by the workers and spread with the workers across the industry. And then we have core people in the workplace. We train as interveners, and we give them the assist course, the Living Works assist course, which is a 2-day workshop. And they get a blue sticker. So I'm at work, I'm doing a tough. Somebody around me might very well notice I'm doing a tough, saying, mate, you don't look too good. What about if we go and see a connector? The connector will talk to me, you know, tease out what the issue are. And then say, well, maybe we need a bit more help here. Take me to an assist worker. The assist worker would ensure safety. And then the assist worker might connect you to a number of different resources. Mating construction is one of them, but we're quite happy if they use the employer's employee assistance program and they take them to the local general practitioner. It doesn't matter as long as people get connected to the best possible help. But we provide what we call case management services. We don't provide any clinical services at all, but we would have case managers would go down to those workers, identify it and say, all right, yesterday you were suicidal, what got you there? All right, I'm going through a divorce, I've got financial problems, might have mental health problems. Okay, let's find some resources for you to address those various issues. And then we connect with you as you access those resources and sort of support you in doing it, but we don't provide any of them. And the benefit of that is that we're not vested in, if something doesn't work for you, there's no problem talking to us about it doesn't work because we're not vested in, you're not criticizing us. We are just mm-hmm. the people who walk with you as you access those services. And often we talk about men don't want sympathy, we want solidarity. We're just someone who is prepared to actually just walk with us as we do those things as tough. So that's
I'm feeling a bunch of these taglines. These are great. Men don't want sympathy, they want solidarity. Yep, that's going on a bumper sticker. Okay.
But what is actually important about this is not so much we do that on a side by side. What is really important is we do this as an industry. So we never do any fee-for-service work, and no employer can actually purchase our services. They can only take them for free. So when we go on a site, we thank the employer for allowing the work time to engage with this issue, which is really important. And we thank the workers for being part, for standing up and being part of the solution. But it's ultimately something we do together. It is something we take joint responsibility for. It's not something we rely on our employer to fix for us. We have mm-hmm. to own the problem together. Of course, nothing is free. You know, it costs money to run a program. We got about 40 staff nationally. So you need to generate an amount of money to do that. But we rely on, we get 80% of our funding from the industry through generosity. So we don't sell our program. We do sell the social capital that comes with it. So we do enter into partnerships with businesses. They will get the program whether they pay or not. But by being a partner, then allows them to go to their employees and say, I'm partnering with the people who support you. We're on this journey together. They can do fundraising events on the work site, barbecues and all those kind of things. Each of those things reinforce what we do as an industry. We're on a joint journey. It doesn't matter who you work for. It doesn't matter what you do. That we found was really important in the construction industry because we would probably get to the big end of town quite easily. But most of the people who are at the highest risk of suicide in the construction industry are actually not employed by the biggest companies. 90% of people are employed by small business who would find it difficult to engage with a program such as ours on a one-by-one basis, if that makes sense.
Totally. Yep. Wow. This is fantastic.
So if I can give you an example, I've learned even more tonight than I did before. Sorry?
Go ahead. I've learned even more tonight than I knew about before. You continue to expand your model. Did I see you also have a hotline or a support line? Do you have a phone service?
Yes, we started because we have about 10,000 volunteers. Mm-hmm. And obviously, it would be completely irresponsible for us to have that number of volunteers without providing support to them. So we started the hotline predominantly to support the volunteers. So if they were with somebody they were struggling, that they had somewhere to call up for support. What is happening is workers use the line directly, and I'm totally good with that. So most of the calls we get from the hotline is not actually people calling up saying, you know, using the F word, saying, I'm not feeling too well. It's someone calling up and saying, I'm with Peter and Peter's not right. You need to talk to Peter. Here he is. So it's actually people connecting people to the hotline. And that's where it works. And that tells us that people are getting the message.
Fantastic. I want to transition now
Good. I just want to say, in terms of the cultural changes, just a bit I want to talk to you about, Sally, is that the bit we know how it works is 2 years ago, we put out the challenge saying, fly the flag from H and Construction on International Suicide Prevention Day. Just a half-baked idea saying, why don't we just contact the connectors? We have the volunteers and say to them, they can contact us, they can get a Mates in Construction flag. We want them to raise the flag on that site, and we want every worker on that site to get together and take a pledge that we look out for each other in this industry.
Wow.
So this was totally grassroots, just the volunteers, ordinary construction workers, carpenters and plumbers and safety guys. The first year, we had about 25,000 workers engaged in that project. The second year, we had about 35,000 workers on about 400 or 500 sites.
Wow.
Just doing this locally, if we are relying entirely on business structures to this, we would have to have staff and people and all that. We could not sustain this scale. So the key to this is by using the industry as our key agitators and actors, we get a scale we can't get without them.
Incredible. You're absolutely right. And you've made you've positioned this so it is kind of an aspiring engagement, like people want to be a part of it. It's something people are proud of. They want to increase their, you know, from white to green to blue sticker. You have made it something so positive that people want to reach out and get involved rather than something so daunting and scary. Brilliant. Tell me a little bit now, let's shift our gears a little bit. Tell me a little bit about the research, the findings around the return on investment study you've done or studies, and really about your partnership with academia. I know right now we're quite a ways behind you in the United States trying to figure this out. And there's been a little bit of cultural challenge between industry and how things happen and how quickly things move and how little time there is versus academia, where it's methodical, it's slow, it's long, it's intense and so forth. Can you talk a little bit about the science behind your work and really how you've learned to partner so well with the researchers?
Sometimes you're just given a gift, Sally. we started with a really good base because we started with a research project by Griffith University and Jacinda Howgood and people we know from the sector that gave us some reasonably clear guidelines for what to do. We just had to find a construction way to do it. So we did that. Then I was really fortunate. I met a fella, an absolutely amazing fella called Graham Martin, which is one of the leading people in suicide prevention. He's retired now, but in Australia. And he joined our board and gave us guidance in terms of understanding, because I'm a plumber. I don't do academic research generally. It's not one of my strengths. But he helped us in terms of saying, what can we do to prepare ourselves forward? We didn't do research into it first because it was important for us to get traction with the industry, because otherwise we'd just be a flash in the pan. So we needed to go out and become important to the industry quite a while. So we really had to focus on getting scale and reach first up. So we did that. But as part of that, we counted everything. We collected data as we went. We asked questions and so on. So about 4 years into it, Graham Martin then went back and had a look at the data and did the first evaluation we did, which was more of an outcome evaluation in terms of whether people actually felt more equipped and with the social validity of the program and stuff like that. And it was a really good evaluation from our point of view in terms of validity of it. But we have, since early days, allocated an amount of money each year for research. And when we look at research, we look at academic quality research, so that it's been frustrating because we've been getting government funding with specific requests of not evaluating. And, you know, why would we do things without knowing whether they work? And even if it doesn't work, we are wasting people's money that could actually be spent mm-hmm. better at something that does work. And unfortunately, I think as a sector, we really need to get our head around what evidence-based practice means, because it's a word that is so wide that for some evidence practice meant I asked people 10 questions after it, whether they liked it or not. And if they liked it, then I'm evidence-based. I actually mm-hmm. think we need to have some standards around that say we need to have different levels of evidence-based in terms of outcomes, in terms of so on. So one of the gifts we have been given is that we have reached scale because of the model and because of the industry support, where we've actually been able to do outcomes in terms of suicide reductions. So we had a we had a paper published in 2011 that looked at the first sort of initial outcomes in terms of process that gave us the confidence to keep going and spreading. But we had a five-year mirror review done where we looked at 5 years prior to mating construction, 5 years post-mating construction, where we were associated with a 7.8% reduction in suicide in Queensland. Mm. Now, there's some issues with statistical significance and stuff like that we have to acknowledge, because we still only had a 20% penetration at the end of that period. So there's some limitations about it. But it certainly gives us some clear indications that there was a reduction in suicide in Queensland. We can't say it's ours, but it didn't happen in New South Wales. It didn't happen in any other states where we didn't run the mating construction program. So we need to look further into. The other bit we have done is we partnered up with people around return on investment. So we partnered up with Professor Chris Doran out of he was at the Hunter Medical Research Institute at Newcastle University, to start quantifying what does this actually cost. And this is one thing that when we started talking to our constituents, which is construction workers, about doing this economic evaluation, we had a very, very strong and very powerful reaction from them saying, how dare you putting a price on this? If you have experienced a suicide, you know that there'll be no way we can reasonably quantify this in terms of money. And of course, it's a very fine balance we have to do, because if I want to talk to decision makers, I have to have hard facts. But we did this initially. It was a return on investment study on the cost of suicide within the industry, and the quantity was the cost of suicide in the Australian construction industry alone, using widely approved methods for cost analysis, is about $1.5 billion per year,
mm-hmm.
which is like staggering considering when you consider that there's only 23 million people in Australia.
That's right. Yeah, like the size of Texas for the United States.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The other bit that came with that was they then looked at what the cost of the intervention was and worked out there was a return on investment of $4.60 for every dollar invested. Now, that's obviously a powerful financial environment, right, argument. But it also highlighted that the suicides we're seeing is really only the tip of the iceberg. Below that sits more than twice the number of people who are permanently disabled following a suicide attempt, and many more people who had the time off work following a suicide attempt and who are less than productive because of it. So Christone have done a number of reports for us around that, looking at the different costs of suicide in individual states, but also in terms of return on investment. And the other thing we have done is we partnered up with University of Melbourne, Dr. Alison Milner, to do an annual report. So we now produce an annual report that gives us a state of suicide rates within the industry so that we can actually look at it over time to see, are we making a difference? Are things getting better or worse? and we can keep reminding the industry that this is still a problem we haven't fixed. And what we've also done is we've done some research around the kind of knowledge level around suicide interventions, what's evidence-based practice in the area, and also mental health generally. So we started, and I know this is work that you've done, Alison, in the US that we sort of picked up on and got inspiration from. So I think it's sort of the mutual admiration society here, where you did a blueprint with the industry, with the construction industry to start with.
Mm-hmm.
We started a roundtable process in September last year where we got the key leaders of the industry together for a day to set the benchmarks down for a blueprint, and then we have been working over. We developed a strategic statement for the industry, and we are now developing a blueprint for better mental health and suicide prevention for the construction industry that we hope to put out later this year. So we are sort of probably playing catch up with you in that area, but that is just to say, well, let's put some framework, because this is more than just mates in construction. The agenda is much wider than just ours. There's also some policy issues. There's some general, you know, support issues,
yep.
All those kind of things, and try to drag some of them into the debate and widen the platform a little bit from simply just suicide prevention.
Wonderful. So in the last few minutes we have here before I wrap up, can you give us some takeaways maybe that go beyond construction for other workplace leaders here? Some tips you'd like to, you know, three or four tips if you'd like the listeners to really remember, or how they might avoid some pitfalls, or where people should start. Are there some strategies you can recommend that are kind of meta beyond just construction?
I say nothing about us without us.
Mm-hmm.
If we do suicide prevention, we need to start with the target audience, and it has to be developed from there out. We too often try to come with prepackaged solutions and put them on to be. Now, because we have had some, you know, scored some goals in terms of this, people come, well, can you just come and run this for us as well? No, we can't, because I'm not a transport worker. I'm not a energy worker. But we can certainly help you with the lessons we have, and you can work out what is culturally appropriate from you. So I think that we have to build it from the culture we are trying to target out, rather than trying to come with the final result and make them fit a culture. I also think that when we go into a culture, it is really important that we identify that culture is complex. Very often we see the dominant culture as being the only culture. So if you look at a workplace scenario, it's very tempting to go into the workplace with a business through HR, because they want to look after the people, they want to do the right thing. There's no ifs and buts about that. But it is one perspective, and we really need to take the time to understand other people's perspectives as well if we're going to incorporate them into our solution. So I think the takeaway is take your time to build your foundation before we do the intervention, so that we understand the culture right and we build the intervention around the culture.
All right. Wonderful. This has been amazing. And I'm just going to sum up here and then ask you for some final thoughts. So we have been talking about workplace suicide prevention training and changing culture, and really looking kind of overall at the need to involve workplaces, to integrate this into their health and safety culture and make it a priority, especially, I think, in some of the male-dominated industries where we are seeing higher suicide rates and maybe a little bit more challenge on how to integrate these messages and practices around mental health promotion. We listened to your story, Jorgen, about your early days of living with depression, suicidal thoughts and attempts, and how that you had a turning point of moving from that to say you were going to learn from that those experiences and apply that expertise of living through it into helping others. And that's so incredibly inspirational that you have done that and now make such a difference, not just in construction, not just in Australia, but internationally. I love your comment about this aha moment where you're like, hey, I'm looking around and, you know, somebody needs to do something here. And, oh, I guess it's me. and realizing, like, this is a call. This is a call to you and your life's work, and really starting from a place of research and understanding, listening in the industry forum and making this an issue that was not divisive, really working hard to make bridges between the employers and the unions, building trust within these groups so that they could work together for this bigger vision, this bigger mission, and really focusing this effort not around just insisting that people who are struggling be the ones to advocate for themselves and get their own help, but changing the approach to really empowering people to talk to one another and play off the strengths of the industry. So, you know, I hear this in the first responder community as well, that it's all about serving the other. Like, I will step back from the things I need if I know that, you know, my coworker can benefit, or I will sacrifice whatever's important to me so that I can help somebody else. Just helping industry in particular, where there's tight work groups that really depend on each other's lives to get the job done. This is such a superb cultural fit. I love the building into the safety culture that already exists by implementing some of these strategies into safety orientation and toolbox talks and so forth. That I think makes it far more sticky and far more likely to last well beyond any particular champion that's bringing it in. Love your approaches about removing barriers. It doesn't cost anything, which is usually the number one thing that people throw out there. So making the volunteers really incentivized and inspired to do the work as connectors, and then moving up the ladder of credibility and seniority by getting these extra trainings and being really trustworthy within their peer structure, and having those outward facing symbols of the hard hat stickers is just a stroke of brilliance. It's just so amazing, because right away it starts a conversation, and there's some intrinsic motivation to get more involved, to be a better helper for the other people within the structure. The case management services is new since we last talked, or maybe I didn't hear it fully the last time we talked, and we know from the research that the follow-up post-referral is so important. So now that you have a mechanism to build in to make sure the services were a good fit or to give some other options, and the men don't want sympathy, they want solidarity, is such a great mantra. And the public commitment of the raising of the flag and how that's kind of gone viral is, again, just a great example of what's possible when you get people all fired up for this. I don't want to miss underscoring the importance of research. I have met and loved Jacinda Hoggood and Alison Milner and Graham Martin and Chris Dorn, and I just think all of these people that come to this problem with a different set of skills, a different set of tools, and a different mindset really can be amazing partners in helping us figure out what works. The fact that you moved beyond outcome research of, you know, well, certainly beyond satisfaction, did we like the training or not, to is this really working? Are we really reducing suicide? And then really looking at the economic evaluation, which does matter. It is cold, but when you're talking about business executives who are trying to place their dollars in the most efficient and effective way possible, this argument matters. And if we can make that with good research, then we're much more likely to get their support. I'm really excited to hear where you're going to move with the research moving forward beyond just a death focus. I agree, that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's many more ways that we can measure this over time. And your two big takeaways, I think, is really the drive home message. Nothing about us without us. The prepackaged off-the-shelf solutions that are dropped in by an outside quote-unquote expert will not work. And as much as I love these trainings and you use them, you also have tailored them very specifically within the specific culture of construction. And in the show notes, I'm going to put all kinds of resources that we've talked about, obviously Mason Construction, the ROI studies that we've been mentioning, OzHelp, Living Work, both the Safe Talk and the Assist Training, the Blueprint, and whatever else you want me to put in there, Jorgen, I'm happy to do it. And then finally, your last comment about the takeaway about culture being complex. We need to look at all the different perspectives on this to build and take the time to build the foundation that's really going to make this successful. So with a couple minutes closing, do you have any final thoughts? And then I'll just have a couple of closing words.
No, you left me speechless there.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting what you're doing.
Just go out and do it. Just,
yes, let's do it. So I hope, I don't know if I'll see you in Malaysia later this summer, but if I don't, I'm certainly, that's when our next International World Congress is. I will certainly be talking about your model for the delegates there. It is always such an honor to work with you and learn from you, and I hope our paths cross again soon. In addition to the show notes with all of these links, any other questions, listeners, that you have about this particular topic, either within construction or beyond it, please connect with me and I'll be sure to reach out to find some answers for you. You can find more of Jorgen's model at matesinconstruction.org.au. Did I get that correctly? Yes?
Yep.
Okay, good. For more episodes of the Hope Illuminated podcast, please go to my website, sallyspencerthomas.com. And we're doing a time-limited contest. So if you do three things for me, subscribe to the podcast, sign up for the newsletter, and leave a rating and review for the podcast, you'll be in a drawing for a $100 Amazon gift card that I would happily deliver to you. Through the signing up for the newsletter, you'll also be given an announcement of upcoming podcasts. We have such a great lineup coming up over the next several months. And also we do monthly Twitter chats, and I have a blog. So a number of ways to continue to learn from these international world experts. So in closing, I'll share my final motto, which is, let's all open our hearts, let's challenge our thinking, and let's take action to save lives. Together, we can restore dignity and sustain a passion for living. Take care, everybody.
At Boar's Head, we place a premium on authenticity. And the home-roasted flavor of our Ever-Roast chicken is no exception. Inspired by a medley of ingredients from the garden, a family recipe, and slow-roasted craft. It's the authentic taste of home and the unmatched quality of Boar's Head. Ever-Roast chicken, sliced fresh at the deli, only from Boar's Head. Compromise elsewhere. At Boar's Head, we place a premium on authenticity. And the home-roasted flavor of our Ever-Roast chicken is no exception. Inspired by a medley of ingredients from the garden, a family recipe, and slow-roasted craft. It's the authentic taste of home and the unmatched quality of Boar's Head. Ever-Roast chicken, sliced fresh at the deli, only from Boar's Head. Compromise elsewhere.